This is Jim Eakster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet provide signature support for our program. Your number is 877-217-5757. Robin Dow, ready to take your call and send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Smiley Gray Anders Jr., the pride of Natchez, Mississippi, who came to Baton Rouge as a young man, went to Struma High, where his classmate was Billy Ab Cannon. The guy won the Heisman Trophy and led LSU to a national championship. Smiley was there at LSU when that happened as editor of the Reveille. And now, 43 years as of tomorrow after he started a daily column, Smiley Anders is still going strong. And good morning to you, Smiley Anders.
Good morning. Good morning, James. You're looking well this morning. hope things are good with you.
Well, they just can't beat you down. Smiley survived COVID. He is a man who just doesn't quit.
My doctor says I'm like a cat. I just kind of show back up again, you know. I'm still here.
Well, I think you're working on about life number seven.
You say life or wife?
Well, I don't think you've gotten to seven on the wife. You're not Larry King.
No, let's not get carried away. No. I'm about three off on that. Yeah, right.
Well, Lady Catherine, by the way, without her, I don't think you'd be alive, much less writing a column.
Look, I'll tell you how much she loves me. She got up early this morning and made me oatmeal. So, I mean, my God, for an old man, that's the start of a good day when you get oatmeal from your loving wife.
Oatmeal on University Walk. So
yes. Living the life, man. Hey.
Well, Smiley, yeah. if you live long enough, as we talked with Daryl Gissel yesterday, your home in Spanishtown may fund your retirement. I see a house a block away from you is on the market for $1.2 million. $1.2 million, Smiley.
It's just got insane. When we moved here, I mean, there were renovations, there were, you know, old people were, you know, dying, and their families had their old houses, and they didn't know what to do with them, and it was kind of a mess. It could have well turned into a slum, but a lot of young people came in and rejuvenated the neighborhood in a lot of ways. They were brought a lot of energy in and started renovating these old houses, and well, it's a great place to live now, and
it is.
Like you said, the prices are outrageous. I mean, we might not be able to afford to live here anymore. I mean, who would like neighbors like us if they were nice people, you know?
Well, we're visiting with Smiley Gray Anders Jr., and tomorrow will be 43 years, meaning he has logged more than half of his life writing a daily column, which was considered to be perhaps a six-month exercise. Let's see what happens, and boom, it's become part of the fabric of our state. It's an amazing phenomenon.
You never know what people are going to respond to. We did it as an experiment. I was doing business news. I was perfectly happy, and one of the editors had the idea, let's try his little column. He was from the West Coast, where, of course, Herb Cain in San Francisco had a marvelous column, ran more than 50 years in the Chronicle. And he did the little items thing, and, daily items column. You don't really see them anymore. Only a few around the country, I think. So.
And in the last decade, you've gained a whole new audience in New Orleans.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, New Orleans people are actually, you might not realize this, but they're actually a little crazier than Baton Rouge people.
Really?
So we got some great, great stories out of them. And it's really rejuvenating. It's like doing a whole new, it is a whole new audience. And they have great stories. And, French Fry had one about Bourbon Street the other day, and Sherry Bounce and Bourbon Street, and all kind of silly stuff.
Well, Smiley Anders, a listener notes a show we did about a decade ago when you were inducted in the LSU Journalism Hall of Fame. And Smiley on that show, and I recall this, said he had a pot plant, and that would mean a marijuana plant in his backyard. And when he got home, he said he had a crowd. And I said, was it the cops? He said, no, it was the neighbors.
Ah, yeah, that was fun. You had me on with a master gardener. And this lady was really, really interesting stuff about all the plants and stuff. And I'm sitting there listening and, you know, just enjoying it. And I think either she asked me or you asked me, you know, do you grow anything? And I just blurted out, oh, yeah. I said, my marijuana is about 3 feet high now, but I water it a lot. Something like that, something silly. Mm-hmm. And and I realized, oh, my God, I'm on the air here. What am I doing? You know, why were we in fun with that one?
Yes, indeed. And the other night I was walking in your neighborhood and I could smell the distinct aroma of cannabis in the air. Imagine that on University Walk.
You are kidding. You are kidding. My God, I have to have an investigation. I mean, you know, we got million-dollar houses here. We can't be smoking dope in this neighborhood now.
I'm with you.
You know, we're gentrified. Hey.
Don't you love that term, gentrified?
Gentrified, isn't that amazing? It means you can afford $1 million house, I guess.
Well, you know, now that they have $1 million homes in Spanish Town, at 657 Spanish Town to be exact, Smiley Anders, I think the Advocate should come back downtown.
Oh, look, I miss it every day. I mean, we keep moving further and further out, and, well, that was one reason we got a house here was to, heck, I could walk to work from my house. No more.
Well, 43 years of doing this, and, some people, you make it look easy, but it's not so easy. And I would imagine that most of the submissions that you get never see the light of day. You have to make the call, don't you?
Oh, I get 50 or 60 a day, and of that, a very small percentage actually make it into the column. But the thing about that saved me was email, because I'm able to work out of the house for one thing. As I get older, it's a little more difficult to, you know, get around. It's, as you know, I'm kind of tied to oxygen, so I don't really. It's a little. I gotta, you know, carry around a generator or tank or something everywhere I go. So I need to stay home. I can stay home. I get everything I need just about except snail mail right here at home. So it's nice.
The other day I read a story in The Advocate. I think it was Jan Richer who wrote about having lunch with you at the pastime. She said she offered you to take you anywhere you wanted. And first you said Chris's, but then you segued to the pastime. And
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, I did.
You like that place, don't you?
Yeah, I really did. I thought there'd be more stories generated out of there for our discussion. And actually, I was thinking about the hamburger at Ruth's Chris on the lunch menu.
Yeah.
They have the best hamburger at Baton Rouge there. I think you could probably charge them for that plug, but they really do. But then I thought, you know, on second thought, you know, I mean, Randy Westbrook and I go way, way back to his dad, as a matter of fact, was in high school with his dad. And so I said, this is, and of course, when I was at LSU, this is where I eat almost at least once or twice a week. And then I've been known to have a beer or two there on occasion. Mm-hmm. So I thought, let's do it there. And we had a great time. Randy told some stories and about old Joe Lip, the bartender. And so we had a great time. And Jan's a terrific interviewer.
Yes, she is.
Really is.
She's doing some good work now. Tom on Bluebonnet asked if you remember the Brunswick. You've written about it in your books. That was a regal entity downtown, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Chicken and dumplings on Thursday. They had a very unusual hamburger with a kind of a sauce on it, kind of a chopped up pickles and very unusual great hamburger. And they had a pool hall upstairs, so you could you could earn your lunch money upstairs and then go down and have a nice lunch. You know? So it's very nice.
Well, we're so happy that you have stayed the course, and I have a feeling Smiley's going to make it to 50 years writing this column, which would make you one of the longest-serving writers of a column in American history. But Smiley's always been a trailblazer, and it
well, that's incredibly optimistic of you. Thank you. So, I hope I make it that long. So I'll just do what I can to stay upright, and I love what I'm doing. Nobody's ever told me to quit.
Well, we do have to roll, but congratulations to the venerable and the elegant Smiley Gray Anders. We're back with more Talk Louisiana after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. And thanks again to Smiley Anders. And we're joined now by Daryl Hurst, a Democrat, member of the Baton Rouge Metro Council, representing District 5. He was appointed to that position in January to fill the vacant seat left by Erica Green. And then in March, he was elected to serve, and elected by a big margin over two strong candidates. And he, of course, is now an active member of the council and intends to be a force. And we'll start with a few items, but number one on the list of issues of our listening audience, what about St. George? The city of Baton Rouge, the city leaders, won round one in court. Your thoughts, Daryl Hurst?
Well, I'm here for whatever the people want. St. George, what happened in the past, I want to do the best that I can do to make sure that I'm fiscally responsible to the people that pay into the tax system in Baton Rouge and East Baton Rouge Parish, make sure that we have equitable resources for both sides of the line, for both the city of St. George and the city of Baton Rouge. So my view on that is wherever the court system decides to land it, either short term now, where they say it's not feasible due to the $48 million imposition we'll put on the citizens of Baton Rouge, or in the future, if that changes and it passes, I'm going to do my best to make sure that everybody has a great place to live, work, and play.
So where do you stand right now?
Well, right now, wherever the court stands is where I stand. It hasn't passed.
All right. But do you have a personal opinion about this? You are an office holder.
So I will tell you, I am for one Baton Rouge. I do understand some of the reasons why St. George wanted to be created, because of the challenges in the public school system, some of the challenges locally. And I believe that God put me in this position to help remedy some of those things so that we can have that unified force of being one Baton Rouge. So, my kids transparently go to private school, because of where I'm zoned to, and some of the things that have happened over the years. I've had some distrust in the school system myself. So I understand the reason why people are choosing to be a part and would like St. George to come into effect. But I hope to be a force from the city council. Well, I've actually reached out to both of my school board members that support my area so that we can be the change and finally close that gap between education, which is controlled by the state, and the community, which is ultimately managed by city resources.
So you have usurped the public school system with your kids, and you're not alone, but rarely do we have a public official acknowledge this. Where would they be going to school if they weren't going to private school?
Well, let me make this clear. There are some great teachers and there are some great schools in East Baton Rouge Parish. When I moved back to Baton Rouge, I took a stint out of state for a little bit, just work wise. I saw some of the challenges that were being faced at the time. Now, a lot has changed since then. Once I put them in the private school system that went from K to 12, I left it up to them to choose to move if they wanted to. Lehigh would be an option for my son, which I did give to him. in eighth grade going into high school because I believed in the school, its mission, what's happening. I'm zoned to Bel Air, zoned to Greenbrier Elementary for elementary school. Middle will be Park Forest and high school will be Bel Air. So I'm right along that central border corridor. But they are doing some great things to try to transition EBR. And I just want to be a facilitator from the city resource to help make that change happen.
All right. Well, Daryl Hurst, a brave man, a council person who says he is eschewing the public school system to send his kids, I presume, to a private school. Okay. What about crime? That is another issue that is on the forefront of discussion, and we have lots of it in Baton Rouge, particularly murder. And as noted, this is a nationwide phenomenon, and unfortunately, we have these mass shootings that are becoming an epidemic. But can a public official do something about what's happening in Brookstown or some other place that's rife with crime?
Well, Brookstown is my area, so I'm glad you brought that up. So is Zion City. So is the Del Mar area. To it, Carolyn Coleman and I split that, and then Lamont and I split Brookstown. But what I will say is that we are doing something. So the first thing that I did when I came in the office, Jim, is I went to the mayor and I said, hey, we're either part of the problem or we're part of the solution. My community center closes at 5 o'clock. It's in the heart of 70805. The kids don't get off the bus till 4:30. How can we make that change? She said, tell me what you need. So Mayor Broome was welcomed me with open arms with my ideas, provided funding resources. I'm partnering with Jacobs Engineering, ExxonMobil, to create STEM and other programs. Had a conversation yesterday with Chris Engel with the YMCA about managing a tutoring portion of what we're doing there. So socioeconomics is, improvement is a long-term. That's why you don't see as much crime where you have higher median incomes. Because crime is not what people want to do. A lot of times it's an act of survival. And so there was a study, and it was a while back, and I don't know all the exact details, but they took a bunch of affluent people, put them in a position where they were no longer affluent, and they ended up resorting to things that they would not normally do for survival skills for food. So at some point, you adapt to your habitat, regardless of where you come from. It's about where you are. And so for that reason, you know, for me, I understand that. And so I've taken that proactive approach to create youth programming to kill that idle time, which is what people say is the devil's workshop, right? And start closing some of those gaps. We're working on a stock trading program where each kid will get $200. Had a conversation with Duke Williams with Duke Partners, and we're connecting with Merrill Lynch to teach urban kids how to start investing at a young age to change their stars.
All right. Do we need we're venturing into a lot of area here, but obviously these crimes are largely committed with guns. Do we need to do something about laws regulating gun safety?
So, I mean, I've seen the debate federally on that. I'm a hunter. I'm an outdoorsman. I'm a true Louisiana guy. And so for that reason, I don't have the full answer. I'll let the feds duke it out before we bring it to a local level. But what I will say is I do believe in gun safety, for sure. And Jim, the one thing that I can tell you is in my short period of time of being a councilman, I've gotten the trust of the public that maybe the DA's office or the chief of police or the sheriff has not been able to access. So I have a lot of these guys who are facing charges now committed with crimes for attempted murder, and they are coming to me and saying, we really don't want to live this life. Can you help me change? So we've started a ceasefire campaign, and it's catching like wildfire. So when you talk about can we stop it, man, you know, half of that happens in the home, Jim.
But can the guns get removed from people who are going to use them in bad ways? Or is that a lost cause?
We probably need to have the biggest magnet in the world and stick it in the air and hope that the guns come out of the homes and stick to the magnets. Other than that, I don't think that that's going to happen, because in some of these neighborhoods, it's survival of the fittest. And so because guns started something, they'll also end it as well. And some of these young folks, I've talked to them, I've asked them, hey, man, why do you carry a gun? They say I carry it for protection. I don't go out and attempt to start things, but I definitely want to make sure that if anything comes to my doorstep, that I can defend myself.
What about assault weapons? Do we need assault weapons?
You know, do we need assault weapons? The answer is no. Am I against assault weapons? I'm for proper gun use. So I have friends that hunt with assault style weapons that are semi-automatic, not automatic, right? Do we need automatic weapons? No. Are assault rifles any different than if I came in there with a 30-06? Absolutely not. It's still a high power rifle that can be used in multifaceted. So am I against assault rifles? No, but I am against improper use of guns.
877-217-5757. We'll spend a few more minutes with Daryl Hurst, councilman for East Baton Rouge Parish, representing District 5, and we will return with more Talk Louisiana after this quick pause. Hear more from Councilman Hurst. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Councilman Daryl Hurst is with us for a few minutes longer. If you'd like to get in under the wire, 877-217-5757. He's talking about crime in Baton Rouge. We have one of the highest per capita murder rates in America in this city. And he represents a district that has some trouble spots. And Daryl, of course, like others, wants to do something about it. But he stopped short of saying, we need a ban on assault weapons. He says no. And, of course, he's not alone in that viewpoint. I would suspect he represents a majority of the Louisiana electorate and citizens, but I'm not so sure he represents a majority of his constituents. That's why he's brave to say what he's saying. But let's take a call or two or three. There is still time. I see a line open, 877-217-5757. Mitchell in Sherwood. Mitchell, you're on with Councilman Hurst. Hi, Mitchell.
Hey, good morning to you. Councilman Hurst, are you over the area that's in between Adams Street, in between Ardenwood and Foster? Because they got them plants there that's got the concrete with the steel spearing out stuff that's environmentally, it's harming people on that street. And the city fixed the street years ago and destroyed a lot of other people's houses that was in the extra back house they had when made a flood when they fixed the street because they put the drains wrong.
All right. That's another topic. But Councilman Hurst, do you know anything about what Daryl's saying? What Mitchell's saying?
No, so that's not my area. I do have a concrete plant on Greenwell Springs that does the same thing. We've been fighting with them to mitigate spillage and to ensure that our roads stay in a great position. Unfortunately, Greenwell Springs is not under the city. It's actually a state street. So I've been working with Senator Regina Barrow, and now that former Representative Ted James's seat has been filled with Vanessa LaFleur, she covers that area. I'll be working with her as well. But in terms of your area, I don't, but I would, you can definitely reach out to, I believe it's Councilman Cleve Dunn.
All right.
And express that concern and give him all the details. Or you can just dial 311 and report it. And then it will go into that system and we'll send somebody out there to inspect it.
Hopefully this is the first of many times we'll have Councilman Hurst on. And he is correct that many of these issues that he's questioned about, for example, I hear Metro Council people question about abortion, and they don't have any more to do with abortion rights or taking those rights away than I do, but they get questioned about it. And here's another one regarding guns. Are you in favor of universal background checks? Would you like to see that?
So let me tell you where I am. I'm okay with background checks. I mean, I think background checks is kind of like the happy medium. Like, we don't take them off the street, but that's proper gun use, right? So if, I look at, so when I've been given guns before, and what I'll do when I'm given a gun is I will go to somebody who can actually do a proper transfer from, because anything that happened with that gun prior to me receiving it, I want to make sure that there's a stamp in time when I receive that firearm. So I am for proper transfers, proper background checks, and I think that's just being responsible to the citizens to make sure that guns are in people's hands that are allowed to have them.
What about a mandatory 21-year age limit for purchasing weapons of this kind?
Well, if you can go to the Army at 18, you should be able to have a gun at 18. That would be my stance on it. I started hunting when I was a little boy. So, and I had my first rifle at 18. So I'm that I own with my name on it.
All right, but so you're not allowed to drink legally at 18 or smoke legally, or buy cigarettes at 18. Why should guns be different?
Well, if I can go to the military and be properly trained, it goes back to proper training on how to use a firearm and do it to protect the people that are in our city, in our state, in our country, then I should be able to also buy one. And
I think you're resonating with a lot of people about proper training, but as we know, you don't have to have proper training to purchase an AR-15 at 18, as we found out in Uvalde, Texas. Should safety be a requirement for purchasing a weapon? Should a safety course be necessary?
I would actually agree with that. It's probably the first time I've been asked, but it's no different than going to hunter safety, right? The proper way to manage a gun in the woods so that you don't mistake a human for a bear for a human, right? And so there's a whole lot that you learn in these safety classes. And I would encourage anyone that does have a firearm to take a safety class. Anyone that's encouraging their kids to go hunting to make sure that they take that class before they put their kids in the woods, and is there for a reason.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, Councilman Hurst, and we look forward to a visit very soon again. Thank you, sir. Appreciate you.
Absolutely. Y'all have a blessed weekend.
And you too. We're joined now by Jason Berry, excuse me, the remarkable investigative reporter in New Orleans and elsewhere, but New Orleans is his city, and he wrote eloquently about New Orleans and City of a Million Dreams, and he is in St. Francisville today for the Walker Percy Festival. And City of a Million Dreams, the documentary, is showing at 4:30 at Grace Episcopal Church. There is no charge. You just have to get one of the seats before it's taken at the Walker Percy weekend. And it is always a pleasure to visit with Jason Berry. Good morning, Jason.
Thank you, Jim, and it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, Walker Percy is the inspiration for this weekend, festival, whatever we want to call it. But for those who I think you probably knew him personally, I never met the man, although he was briefly on the LSU board. I was in the audience for one board meeting that he promptly resigned from the board after Buddy Romer appointed him. But nonetheless, he was a Louisiana treasure, wasn't he?
Well, he was indeed, and I have to tell you that Walker Percy was responsible for my first book contract. This was back in 1972. I was only a year out of college, and I had worked in Mississippi for Charles Evers, the civil rights leader, when he ran for governor, and I bravely set out to write a book about that experience at the age of 22. And I did a little piece for the Vieux-Carré Courier in New Orleans on Southern politics, and he saw it. And I had met him about 8 months before, spent a lovely afternoon with him, set up by a mutual friend. And he called me and said, "I see you're working on your book." And he had a connection with an editor at Saturday Review Press in New York. She had called him asking if he wanted to do a book on Southern politics. I remember he told me, I said to her, "That's not my bag." And of course, "not my bag" is the James Brown phrase from those days. And so I sent the manuscript, and 3.5 weeks later, I had a contract. The book is Amazing Grace with Charles Evers in Mississippi, sadly out of print. But I will never forget that. He was most helpful. He was a true gentleman. And his books are, I think, read across the world in many languages today.
Almost 50 years ago, and City of a Million Dreams is about New Orleans. The documentary is showing at 4:30 in St. Francisville, and you also will have, don't you have a stretch at the Broad Theater in New Orleans coming soon as well?
We do. The film is opening on June 17th and will run for 2 weeks. The book is a character-driven narrative that opens with Bienville, the founder of New Orleans, and it closes with the Confederate statues coming down. The film has a much tighter thematic lens. You can only view so much in 90 minutes, but I use jazz funerals as a lens on the history of the city. I filmed funerals for many years, sometimes with grant support, sometimes grub-staking the shoots when I had the money. And then over the last 5 years, I got pretty serious and raised funds and then got an investor and finished it. It's been to film festivals, 7 so far. We've been getting great reviews. And this is the road that independent films travel before getting on a streaming platform or a network. You have to show that people like it. And so we're on a good march. And I hope the good folks in St. Francisville like it. And I would invite any of your listeners who live near St. Francisville to come join us at 4:30. As you said, there's no cover charge, but with 125 seats, it is first come, first served.
It is. And I'm sure the documentary will be every bit as good as the book. And the book was quite special. And another one of the must reads for people who treasure New Orleans, and brings us to a question from a listener about the moviegoer, Walker Percy's perhaps most famous work. I was looking, 1961, 61 years since it was published. It holds up well, doesn't it?
Oh, I think it's a classic. And your listener is quite right to reference it. You know, he wrote about the existential angst that people felt then, and certainly I think people feel now, the idea of being overwhelmed by what he called everydayness. And it's the story of Binks Bolling, who is a stockbroker living in a little house in Gentilly, and he's overwhelmed by his sort of marginal status in the world. And he goes to movies to enhance his sense of reality. It's a kind of ironic approach, because most of us go to movies to escape reality, you know, to have a little entertainment. But it's a brilliant novel and long lasting indeed.
It is a classic in 61 years, but I read it when I was in college at LSU, and the theater that is featured in the movie is still there, isn't it? Or it's featured in the book, The Moviegoer.
You may be right. I can't remember which theater it is. I'm sorry. I've read the book 3 times, but not lately.
Well, we'll talk more with Jason Berry after this quick timeout on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and a few more minutes with Jason Berry, the remarkable writer, the guy who is most responsible for unearthing the tragic episode that involves sexual abuse in the priesthood of the Catholic Church, a church that he belongs to. And it's always a pleasure to talk with Jason, and I hope we have him back soon for an extended visit. But 4:30 today, you could see the documentary City of a Million Dreams at St. Francisville, the Walker Percy Weekend, Grace Episcopal Church, 4:30. There are just over 100 seats available, so you want to be there. And Jason, we have quite an enlightened audience. Several listeners have sent messages. The theater we were thinking of and the moviegoer is the Britannia, which is still open, apparently. And it is a treasure for New Orleans.
It is indeed. The first movies I ever saw as a young kid were at the Britannia, science fiction movies. I was, I guess, probably 5 or 6. And it's indeed a marquee location in New Orleans.
5339 Britannia Street. So, and you know, we don't have those kinds of theaters around much anymore. It may be one of the few, if it may be the only one left in Louisiana of its kind.
I don't know that for a fact. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. One thing that is interesting is how well built many of those old theaters were. The Carver Theater in New Orleans is of that ilk. It is now a public event place. They do show films there, but they also have concerts, public meetings, things like that. It's on Claiborne Avenue in the Tremaine neighborhood. I remember there was also a theater called the Happy Hour.
There you go.
At Coliseum Square. I don't know exactly what it is today, though I don't think it's a functioning theater.
Well, thank you, Jason. 4:30, Grace Episcopal, St. Francisville, City of a Million Dreams, the documentary. Jason, keep going. It's always a pleasure. You inspire me. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim, so much.
And we're joined for a few moments by Dr. Jay Baruch, professor of emergency medicine at Brown University's Alpert Medical School. He has written about life in the ER. It is a book that, of course, has even more relevance based on events of this week in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Who would have thought that a hospital would be a shooting gallery? But Dr. Baruch, you have been on the front lines of caring for people, and in the book, you delve into issues that go beyond physical maladies. Tell us more.
Yes, thank you, Jim. It's a really honor. I'm so thrilled to be here on your show and just have some time with your listeners. So what drove me to write this book, Jim, is that, you know, I think that the toughest part of what I do in my work isn't necessarily what's portrayed in sort of the media, like all the blood and the high waters drama, but as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, that is a definite part of what I do. But I think often on a daily basis, on a regular basis, the biggest challenge is often how do I find the heart of a patient's story and respond to that? And these are often sort of broken stories, because in addition to challenges of the body and illness and injury, there's often other confounding variables like social issues, economic woes, mental health problems, substance use issues, and lousy luck. You know, and how do I get to the heart of those stories, and how do I respond to them in a meaningful way? And I tried to capture that in the stories and the essays in this book.
The book is Tornado of Life, A Doctor's Journey Through Constraints and Creativity in the ER. Now, if a person has a good attitude, a good outlook, does that help their chances of survival if they're facing a life crisis?
Well, it doesn't hurt. Huh. You know, I think there's literature that shows the connection between sort of the mind and the body. That's a really interesting question, and I think at the very least, to promote that possibility, the first step that I have, especially when I'm often meeting patients for the first time, is to try to make certain that I'm getting their story right, that I'm truly listening to what they're saying, and more importantly, realizing that oftentimes these really challenging experiences are oftentimes difficult to put into words for patients. They're really challenging. Am I listening in the right way? Mm-hmm. Sometimes they say so much. Sometimes they're very withholding because it's what they have to say is embarrassing. They're ashamed. They're trying to find language for really difficult experiences that they're trying to understand as well. So I have to get to that, part of their story first.
Well, the book is an important one, and it not only includes stories about patients, but Dr. Baruch has been affected, as you would imagine any sensitive person would be, and a professional who deals with people at a crisis in their lives in the ER. The book is Tornado of Life, A Doctor's Journey Through Constraints and Creativity in the ER, from MIT Press, and it is just out, an important book. Thank you, sir. It is unfortunate that we have just a short visit, but it is an important book in these times. Thank you, Dr. Baruch.
I really am grateful for it, and thank you, Jim, and my best to your listeners.
And to you. And we're joined in our home stretch by Paul Braun, the Capital Access reporter for WRKF and WWNO, and the legislature is shutting it down next week, 3 days to go in the session. And, Paul, it's a crescendo at the finish line. There's a lot going on.
Absolutely. I mean, yesterday was a very busy day at the Capitol with discussion of abortion really taking center stage, as it has for much of this session, with that sort of pending Supreme Court decision that could undo the 50-year precedent of Roe v. Wade and the constitutional right to an abortion. So Louisiana lawmakers have prepared for years for that eventuality, passing all sorts of trigger laws that would take effect upon that event. And those, a big bill that would coalesce a lot of those laws and stiffen criminal penalties for abortion providers, passed its last major legislative hurdle. It cleared the House last night. There were some significant amendments. The bill actually tripled in length on the House floor. The Senate will have to sign off on those amendments, but it's just one step away from the governor's desk.
Well, one bill criminalizes selling abortion pills through the mail. A second measure would immediately close all abortion clinics and criminalize most pregnancy termination actions and send physicians who perform the procedures to prison. This is physicians, not patients. But Governor Edwards, who is pro-life, said on his radio show that he is in favor of measures that include exceptions for life of the mother, rape, incest, and these don't. That trigger law doesn't include rape or incest. It includes life of the mother. So would that in any way affect how he might approach this?
Maybe. I mean, it hasn't stopped him before. In 2018, Governor Edwards signed Louisiana's heartbeat ban, which would have banned most abortions after 6 weeks of a pregnancy. A year before that, he signed a 15-week ban modeled after the Mississippi law at the center of this Supreme Court case. Neither of those had exceptions for rape or incest. And the big difference there was that those were hypothetical. And now, you know, this bill, when it's coming up to him, it's a lot more relevant because we expect the Supreme Court to undo Roe v. Wade, and all of these trigger laws that were predicated on that happening will hit the books in Louisiana and take effect. So we'll see if Edwards changes his mind on that. It would be an interesting reversal. It's worth noting that Governor Andy Beshear of Kentucky, a Democrat in a red state, similarly vetoed an abortion restriction that had some of that lacked those rape and incest exceptions. So we'll see if Edwards takes a similar stance. There's good examples of it around the country to look to.
Now, these bills in the House, both of them passed by veto-proof margins, but as we know, when governors get involved, sometimes votes can go the other way. The vote for criminalizing most pregnancy termination actions, 72 in favor, 25 against, and 8 not voting, and the vote for penalties for distribution of abortion pills, 72, 24, and 9. So it is a case in which it's an overwhelming majority that is, quote, pro-life, but this is a tough topic, and the Louisiana legislature is composed mostly of men who will never have to decide whether or not to have an abortion. It is a case in which they are not, Paul, shy about getting into this sensitive area, though. They seem to be wanting to go full bore.
Certainly not. And I mean, it's worth noting that, you know, there's not, in the Senate at least, there's 5 women in the Senate, all of whom are anti-abortion and opposed to abortion rights. So, and the sponsors of both of these pieces of legislation were women as well. Women have been a long been a part of the anti-abortion movement in Louisiana and elsewhere. But yeah, I mean, it is interesting when you look at the composition of the legislature. Very few women compared to the population of this state, and it's an interesting dynamic.
Well, it'll be fascinating to see how the finish line looks next week, and we'll get hopefully a report from you at the end of the week about what happened. But a listener notes that the abortion pills, a provider was on this show saying they can only be used in the first 9 weeks of a pregnancy. That is very soon in a present pregnancy, but yet the legislature, 72 members of the House, said no pills either. So it is interesting how our state lawmakers are weighing in on this. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Until next week, stay tuned.